The Honorable, the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Justice Kavanaugh has the opinion of the court this morning in case 22-529, Cantero versus Bank of America.
The national banking system began in 1863 when Treasury Secretary Salmon Chase proposed, Congress passed, and President Lincoln signed the National Bank Act. That act grants national banks, such as today Bank of America, various powers, including the power to administer home mortgage loans. When national banks make home mortgage loans, they offer escrow accounts. When the borrower makes a mortgage payment, the borrower puts money into an escrow account operated by the bank. The bank then uses the funds in escrow to pay the borrower's insurance premium and property taxes on the borrower's behalf. In 2010, Alex Cantero and the other plaintiffs here obtained home mortgage loans from Bank of America to purchase homes in New York. The mortgage contracts required the borrowers to make monthly deposits into escrow accounts. Under New York state law, when a bank maintains an escrow account in connection with a mortgage, the bank must pay borrowers 2% annual interest. But Bank of America did not pay interest on the money in the escrow accounts. Bank of America said that the New York law was preempted by the National Bank Act. The plaintiffs disagreed and filed suit against Bank of America in federal district court in New York. The district court ruled for the plaintiffs, but on appeal, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit reversed and held that the New York 2% interest on escrow law was preempted by the National Bank Act. Relying primarily on principles articulated by this court in 1819 in the landmark case of McCulloch versus Maryland, the Court of Appeals held that federal law preempts any state law that purports to exercise control over a federally granted banking power, regardless of the magnitude of its effects. In the court's decision today, we vacate the Second Circuit's judgment and remand for further proceedings. In the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, Congress passed and President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010. Among other things, Dodd-Frank established the controlling legal standard for determining when a state law like New York's law here is preempted with respect to national banks. In a somewhat unusual statutory provision that expressly incorporated one of this court's cases into the U.S. Code, the Dodd-Frank Act provided that the National Bank Act preempts a state law only if the state law, quote, prevents or significantly interferes with the exercise by the National Bank of its powers in accordance with the legal standard for preemption in the decision of the Supreme Court of the United States in Barnett Bank versus Nelson, 1996, end quote. That is actually in the statute. So the question of whether New York's interest on escrow law is preempted must be analyzed under Dodd-Frank's prevents or significantly interferes preemption standard, and to guide judicial application of that standard, Dodd-Frank expressly incorporated this court's decision in Barnett Bank. So courts must follow Barnett Bank. As it turns out that Barnett Bank painstakingly examined many of this court's older precedents to determine whether a state law regulating national banks falls on the permissible or preempted side of the significant interference line. Those precedents furnish content to Barnett Bank's significant interference test and therefore also to Dodd-Frank's preemption standard incorporating Barnett Bank. You'll be happy to know that I'm not going to review all of those older precedents with you today, but the courts that must apply the Barnett Bank standard are not so lucky. Courts assessing preemption questions must follow Barnett Bank and that means they must carefully parse the precedents on which Barnett Bank relied. In analyzing the New York interest on escrow law at issue here, the Court of Appeals did not conduct that kind of nuanced comparative analysis. Instead, the Court of Appeals applied a more categorical test that would preempt virtually all state laws that regulate national banks. In this court, Bank of America argued in favor of the Court of Appeals approach. By contrast, the plaintiffs advocated that we yank the preemption standard to the opposite extreme and preempt virtually no state laws that apply to national banks. We appreciate the desire by both parties for a clearer preemption line, one way or the other. But Congress expressly incorporated this court's Barnett Bank test into the U.S. Code. In determining whether the state law at issue there was preempted, Barnett Bank did not draw a bright line. Instead, as I've mentioned, Barnett Bank sought to carefully account for and navigate this court's prior bank preemption cases. In sum, because the Court of Appeals did not analyze preemption in a manner consistent with Dodd-Frank and Barnett Bank, we vacate the judgment of the Court of Appeals and remand the case for further proceedings. The decision of the court is unanimous.
Justice Sotomayor has the opinion of the court this morning in case 22-842, National Rifle Association versus Vulo.
Government officials can speak openly and forcefully about views that they disfavor, and they can attempt to persuade others to follow their lead. Government officials cannot, however, attempt to coerce private parties in order to punish or suppress disfavored views of other parties. Doing so violates the First Amendment. 60 years ago, this court held in a case called Batten Books, Inc. versus Sullivan, that a government official's threat of invoking legal sanctions against a third party to suppress disfavored speech violates the First Amendment. This case requires us to apply that settled principle to determine whether we are faced with a permissible attempt at persuasion or an impermissible attempt at coercion. The National Rifle Association filed a lawsuit against respondent Maria Vulu, the former superintendent of New York's Department of Financial Services. As superintendent, Vulu had significant regulatory and enforcement authority over financial institutions and insurance companies doing business in New York. In 2017 and 2018, Vulu and her department investigated insurance companies that were administering and underwriting policies that the NRA offered to its members. It turned out that these policies violated New York's insurance law. Indeed, Vulu and the companies eventually entered into consent decrees that resulted in penalties for those violations and limited the kind of business, even if lawful, that these companies could do with the NRA moving forward. If that weren't the entire story, we might not be here. But there is a lot more in the NRA's complaint against Vulu. So here we are. Because this case comes to us at the motion to dismiss stage, the court is required to assume that NRA's well-pleaded allegations in the complaint are true. According to the complaint, Vulu did not particularly like the NRA and gun promotion groups generally, and she came up with a campaign to leverage her power in order to stifle their advocacy. The NRA alleges, for example, that Vulu met with the senior executives of one of the insurance companies and told them that she wanted them to aid the department in their campaign to weaken the NRA. Vulu specifically stated that she would look past legal infractions unrelated to any NRA business and not initiate enforcement actions if the company cut all of its ties with the NRA and other gun promotion groups. Weeks later, Vulu issued two guidance letters in which she encouraged regulated entities to review their relationships with gun promotion groups and to take prompt action to manage any risks that might arise from such business relationships. In the press release accompanying the guidance letters, Vulu said the quiet part out loud. She urged businesses in New York to discontinue all their arrangements with the NRA. The question is whether this alleged conduct viewed in context and as a whole is enough to state a First Amendment claim and proceed with the case. The Court of Appeals below said no. It held that Vulu's actions constituted permissible government speech and legitimate law enforcement. This court now reverses. The NRA has plausibly alleged that Vulu invoked the authority of her office to threaten legal sanctions against a third party in order to punish or suppress speech that she disfavored. In her alleged meeting, Vulu essentially told executives of a regulated company to cut their ties, whether they were lawful or not, with the NRA and gun promotion groups, or else they would face adverse consequences. By adding the "or else," Vulu crossed the First Amendment line that this court recognized in Banton Books 6 decades ago. Nothing in today's opinion immunizes advocacy groups like the NRA from regulation, nor prevents government officials from enforcing the law or from speaking their mind. The critical takeaway of the opinion should be that the First Amendment prohibits government officials from wielding their powers selectively to punish or suppress speech, directly or as alleged here, through private intermediaries. For these and other reasons set forth in the court's opinion, the judgment of the Court of Appeals is vacated, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. The decision of the court is unanimous. Justice Gorsuch and Justice Jackson have each filed a concurring opinion.
Justice Alito has the opinion of the court this morning in case 22982, Thornell versus Jones.
32 years ago, Danny Lee Jones brutally murdered Robert Weaver, Weaver's 7-year-old daughter, and Weaver's grandmother in order to steal Weaver's gun collection. The Ninth Circuit held that Jones's Sixth Amendment right to the effective assistance of counsel was violated by defense counsel's failure to introduce certain mitigating evidence during the sentencing phase of his capital trial. In reaching this conclusion, the Ninth Circuit substantially departed from the standard for ineffective assistance articulated by the court in Strickland versus Washington. As our opinion explained, the Ninth Circuit overstated the strength of Jones's new mitigating evidence, and it all but ignored the strong aggravating circumstances in this case. We therefore reversed the judgment below. The opinion of the court is joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. Justice Sotomayor has filed a dissent, joined by Justice Kagan. Justice Jackson has also filed a dissent.
Mr. Clerk, the court will entertain motions for admission to the bar of the court.
A group of attorneys from the Federal Bar Association, presented by Jonathan Hafen.
Mr. Hafen.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From California, Jesse Justin Cuevas. From Florida, Joe Colbert Stanley. From Massachusetts, Madison Fay Bader. David Aaron Michelle. From Minnesota, Amy Elizabeth Boyle. From New Jersey, Dana Lee Francesca Ellie. From New York, Amanda Marie Roland. From Ohio, Erica Dakin Prouty, Lauren Ann Sabo, William John Wehoff, Nina Eileen Webb Lawton. From Oregon, Susan Diane Pitchford, Katrina Ann Seipel, Caitlin Diana Skinner. From Puerto Rico, Jose Carlos Camacho Vasquez, Alberto Lopez Merlan. From Utah, Maria Judith DeMarco, Sarah Ann Hafen, my daughter, Spencer Jonathan Hafen, my son, and Jennifer Lee Tomchak. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted. Your daughter, your son, and the other applicants will be admitted.
Thank you.
A group of attorneys from the National Bar Association, presented by Paulette Brown.
Ms. Brown.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From the District of Columbia, Shannon Nicole Proctor. From the State of Florida, Keandria Janae Davis and Natasha Nicole Harrison. From the State of Georgia, Herbert Adams Jr. From the State of Maryland, Peter Raymond Johnson. And from the State of Texas, Felicia Renee Tizano. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
Thank you.
A group of attorneys from the New York State Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, presented by Stephen Epstein.
Mr. Epstein.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From the State of Maryland, Victor Maximus Sanchez Yoveras Campoyeto. Saul, from the State of New York, Saul Warren Benenfield, Diane Therese Clark, David Johnson Cohen, Danielle Koish, Mehdi Esmidi, Stephen P. Goldenberg, Michelle Janet Hauser, Noreen Ellen McCarthy, Suzanne Marie McElreath, Walter John Thompson, and Emily P. Trott. I am satisfied that each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted. If all of the applicants will stand, the clerk will administer the oath. But before he does so, I would like to extend to each of you a warm welcome as a member of the bar of this court and an officer of the court.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear that as an attorney and as a counselor of this court, you will conduct yourself uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States, so help you God?
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Thursday, the 6th of June at 10 o'clock.